People's Question Time. I'm your host, Roderick Gates. I'll begin with 10 to 15 minutes reviewing some of the latest events today from Robbins, Washington. Afterwards, I invite your listeners to call us and our phone numbers to speak on what issues I've mentioned or others that you want to talk about. There have been Copenhagen erupts over squatter evictions in Copenhagen. Violent clashes have erupted as activists have taken to the streets to protest the eviction of a number of squatters from the Ungarfershed, a youth center. And then there has been, over the last few days, 3 days of troubled world stock markets. And the world stock markets fell on Thursday as fear gripped the markets in East Asia. A France 24 financial correspondent, Lisa Legos, has reported live from New York over the last hour on the latest Wall Street news. Iranian President Ahmadinejad has gone to visit King Abdullah, the King of Jordan. Oh no, Saudi Arabia, sorry. As the two countries have attempted to calm the tensions over Lebanon. I'm sure the U.S. will be irked to see one of its major allies in the Middle East being visited by the Iranian president. And there's confusion now in Ethiopia over kidnapping. One group of tourists, which is believed to have been kidnapped in Ethiopia, may have been found safe and sound, according to their tour operator. The details of the abduction and release of the foreigners remain confused. And in Italy, the Italian president is back in power after a very narrow one-majority vote of confidence. And as some of you listeners might recall, he lost power about 2 weeks ago, reminiscent of Italy's post-war 50-plus governments, because they have proportional representation and parliamentary going. Belgium has been shocked and baffled by multiple infanticide. This is after a woman was stabbed her five children to death before trying to kill herself. No obvious motive is for this murder has emerged. French Airbus workers are now on strike, because Gerhard Schroeder and German Chancellor Merkel decided to pursue cuts. And in the West Bank, Israeli troops have killed what they described as three militants. And in Iraq, U.S., Iran, Syria have joined Iraq for a meeting. U.S. Condoleezza Rice indicated that the United States will attend ministerial-level meeting of neighbors of Iraq, including Iran, Syria, in April, breaking about 20 years in diplomatic bands in Iraq, for example. There's opposition in Senegal to presidential candidates' Wade's win. A Senegal socialist have emerged, have alleged that there has been massive fraud in Sunday's poll and plan to challenge the result. They have apparently swept the incumbent leader back into power. Mr. Wade is pursuing a second term. And in Chad and Darfur, Chad has said no to UN peacekeepers. Chad refuses permission for UN peacekeepers to deploy along its eastern border, saying it prefers a civilian force, police and refugee monitors, etc., to help protect refugees from neighbouring Darfur province in western Sudan. And there's low-cost treatment for malaria. An NGO has persuaded pharmaceutical giant Sanofi Aventis of developing a low-cost anti-malaria treatment with no patient protection. while we in Western society still have to deal with malaria. It's been wiped out, thankfully. Unfortunately, it's rife along with many other diseases in Africa. In Guantanamo Bay, in regards to the Guantanamo Bay Detention Centre, the Australian Prime Minister is now under pressure once again regarding an Australian being held there. Australian Prime Minister John Howard is under more pressure ahead of this year's election, after Australia's only Guantanamo Bay inmate has been charged after about 5 or 6 years with so-called material support for terrorism. In Peru, government wages are on time, which has surprised a few people. Peru's president, Alan Garcia, has told Peruvians, "Tiredness is now a thing of the past, and a campaign to end the habit of the poor timekeeping began on Thursday at precisely 12 p.m. local time." And in Cuba, Fidel Castro has spoken on Venezuela's radio, where he's held a long conversation with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. It's the first time the Cuban leader has spoken in public since his health problems started last July. And in the U.S., the farmers have been stung by a mysterious bee shortage. Beekeepers are stumped by a mysterious phenomena that seeps up 80% of their bee stocks mysteriously disappear in a matter of days. It is thought that the bees are falling victim to a mysterious illness. And in the U.S. again, Republican Senator John McCain announced on Larry King Live, well, one of those late-night talk shows, the intends to seek the Republican Party nomination for president. Though his official announcement is April, I think he said. And in Afghanistan, relations are tense over Taliban resurgence, like because Pakistan's ambassador to Washington has warned that any change in U.S. policy towards Pakistan will cause President Musharraf's government to fall. The U.S. has been threatening to cut aid to Pakistan. Relations between the countries look like they're souring again. The U.S. and North Korea are now engaged in normalization talks in New York next week. The talks follow from the February 13th agreement, in which North Koreans announced they were willing to disarm of nuclear weapons after diplomatic efforts, like the six-party talks. There is now an arms bribery scandal that is resurfacing. Italian businessman Ottavio Quattrocchio could face extradition from Argentina over an arms bribery scandal that has rocked India in the 1980s, a scandal that contributed to the fall of the late Raj Gandhi's government. In Afghanistan, there have been suicide attacks outside U.S. military bases. At least 15 Afghans and 3 foreign soldiers were killed on Tuesday in a suicide attack at an airbase where U.S. President Vice Dick Cheney was visiting, according to the Afghan Interior Ministry. And the two Koreas are back on speaking terms. A South Korean delegation is heading for Pyongyang to discuss resuming aid to their northern neighbor. The visit ends after a one-year freeze on inter-ministerial talks. And in France, Shanghai Stock Exchange shows signs of recovery with a 4% increase in comparison to other world international markets, but other Asian and European markets have again lost ground, while early traders in Wall Street remain cautious. There has been, over the last few years, consistency with U.S. media losing independent writers. This occurred, I think it was in the 1980s. I don't know if any a listener, though you're welcome to call, I may recall, a man called Raymond Bonner. Raymond Bonner was dispatched to a financial desk where he labored for 1 year before taking a leave of absence to write a book about El Salvador. Upon returning to the New York Times, he was first sent back to the financial desk, then later to the Metropolitan desk, clear demotion. He resigned from the New York Times on July 3rd, 1984. Asked in an interview with Mark Herbstadt why he had recalled Bonner from El Salvador in the first place, Abe Rosenthal, then managing director and editor of the New York Times, explained, "The general impression among me and some others was that Bonner was first-rate, but we were really screwing this guy because he wasn't getting what you really need to be a reporter. You don't have to get it necessarily at the Times, but you have to have some background in reporting non-foreign affairs in order to be a foreign affairs reporter. You have to know how a paper runs, what a paper considers its standards, and so on." As a follow-up on this specific story in Mark Herbstadt's On Bended Knee, The Press and the Reagan Presidency, it was published in 1989. That's on page 199. For another account of Bonner's firing, there's Mark Danner's The Truth of Al Mazzot, published in December 6, 1993, referring to page 50F. A quote from page 122 to 23 is, "According to Rosenthal, Bonner was removed because he had never been fully trained in the Times' particular methods. Bonner said he didn't know the techniques of weaving a story together. I brought him back because it seemed terribly unfair to leave him there without training. But training was not the only issue, for that matter," I'm quoting. "As Bonner pointed out to me, he had spent a good part of the 1981 year on the Metro desk. And at least in Rosenthal's case, the question of Bonner's journalistic technique seems to be inextricably bound up with what the executive editor can perceive as the reporter's left-wing sympathies. Several current and former Times employees, none of whom would speak for attribution, pointed to a scene in a Georgetown restaurant a few weeks after the El Mazzot massacre, ran a story. It was the evening of the annual Juridon dinner, in which the Rosenthal criticized Bonner and angrily described the sufferings that communist regimes inflict on their people." Note that Rosenthal's most angry denial, which follows, conveniently sidetracks the central issue. Rosenthal declared on page 121-22, "At no time did anybody in the United States government suggest to me, directly or indirectly, that I remove Mr. Bonner. Anyone who would approach the New York Times and suggest that I remove or punish a correspondent would have to be an idiot. To imply that a man who devoted himself to journalism would remove a reporter because of the U.S. government or the CIA or whatever is ridiculous, naive, cruel, and slanderous. Well, consider editorials on cruelty in the Wall Street Journal, March 19, 1993, page 810, in A.M. Rosenthal's Let's Set the Straight Record, in his letter, Wall Street Journal, April 6, 1993, page 815. Robert Parry also covers this in conjunction with Peter Kornblatt in Iran-Contra's Untold Story, in Foreign Policy in the Fall of 1988, page 3 to 30, at page 6. The U.S. Embassy officials boasted in 1982 that they had forced the New York Times correspondent Raymond Bonner out of the country because of his unfavorable reporting on the Salvadoran government. Robert Parry in Fooling America, How Washington Insiders Twist the Truth, Manufacture the Conventional Wisdom, they published in New York, Morrow, 992, page 207-211. On the impact of Bonner's removal on press coverage in El Salvador, including documentation of how the New York Times' coverage took on the Reagan administration perspective thereafter. There's Michael Massing's About Face on El Salvador, published by the in the Columbia Journalism Review of November-December 1983, pages 42 to 49. Joe Wapinski's Shirley Christian and the Times on Chile, Lies of Our Times, Volume 1, Number 1, page 14 to 15, in a profile of a Latin American reporter hired by Rosenthal in the wake of the Bonner departure. Similar pressures do exist, listeners, in far more mundane contexts than that of the Bonner case. Consider Mark Hirschgard's On Bended Knee, Pressing the Reagan Presidency, pages 186 to 203. The quote from page 159 and 163 is, when the First Lady Nancy Reagan, made a photo opportunity visit to Phoenix House, a drug rehabilitation center in New York City, for example, one New York Times reporter had the temerity to write a story lead, noting the irony of Mrs. Reagan posing with impoverished junkies while wearing a designer dress worth thousands of dollars. The lead enraged one of the paper's senior editors. He stormed into the middle of the newsroom and, in front of numerous other reporters, loudly berated the reporter, yelled him down, warning that the reference to Mrs. Reagan's dress was injurious, both to the Times and to the reporter's career, and ordering the lead changed immediately. Likewise, Lee Lesgaze, who was transferred from the White House beat to the Washington Post style section in 1982, remembered how it suddenly became clear that we were not to take swipes at Nancy Reagan when asked to grant an interview for Hirschgard's book to discuss colleagues' claims that her scripts had frequently been altered and her story proposals rejected by superiors in New York in order to make her coverage less critical of Reagan. CBS reporter Leslie Stahl denied Hirschgard's request to go on the record about the matter, but quickly replied, well, all that happened, and I can't deny it. Martin A. Lee and Norman Solon cover the interesting issue in Unreliable Sources, A Guide to Detecting Bias in the News Media, published in 1990, pages 21 to 22, on the Pulitzer Prize winner columnist Sidney Schakenberg's departure from the New York Times. The very interesting quote is, on August 20, 1985, page 18 of the New York Times carried a cryptic announcement. After 4 years of writing his twice-weekly New York column on the op-ed page of the New York Times, Sidney Schakenberg has been asked to accept another assignment, which is now under consideration. What's the problem? Journalist Pete Hamill later described the evolving focus of Schakenberg's op-ed pieces. The homeless, the injured, the casualties of the indifference of and greed of big builders, bankers, and other pillars of the establishment. His twice-a-week column had been spotlighting the financial beneficiaries of various social ills, taking on some of the people and institutions for whom the Times itself was edited. After the Times terminated his column, Schakenberg resigned from the paper. As Schakenberg said in an interview with a small community newspaper, the closer you step on toes, the closer the toes get to the headquarters of a journalistic organization. The more loudly are the protests registered and the more loudly they are heard. Replying to hundreds of readers' irate letters about the axing of Schakenberg's column, Times Vice Chairman Sidney Grossman summarized the whole sequence of events this way. We came to the conclusion after 4 years that what a better column might be produced by another writer. Carolyn Bass, in their Censorship American Style and Index on Censorship in London, June 1985, pages 6 to 7, has similar anecdotes about reporters Saba, Kopal, Jonathan Twitney, and Seymour Hirsch, Alexander Cockburn, and Jeffrey St. Clair, Whiteout, the CIA, Drugs, and the Press. The same in London Verso, 1998, much more recent, chapters 1 and 2, on the successful campaign to destroy the career of San Jose Mercury. The news, investigative reporter Gary Webb, after his reporting about links between the CIA and drug traffickers. Ramsey Clark, former U.S. Attorney General, in The Fire This Time, U.S. War Crimes in the Gulf, New York, Thundermouth, in 1992. Here's the quote from page 139. Even on the home front, commentators who voiced the wrong opinion about the Gulf War ran into trouble. Warren Hinkle of the San Francisco Examiner was placed on a three-month vacation for his known views against the war, or Dr. Orlando Garcia, a popular talk show host on New York's Spanish language station, WADO, was dismissed for his unbalanced view of the war. Editor Joe Reedy of the Kurtztown, PA Patriot, was fired for writing an editorial, "How about a little peace?" just before the bombing started. In an editorial explaining why Reedy was fired 2 weeks into the bombing, 2 weeks after, the paper said that the time for debate has passed. There's also been bigotry in Media Monopoly, Boston, Beacon 5th edition in 1997, the original is 1983, especially chapters 2 to 8, many revealing examples of the pressures on journalists and editors, or Michael Parenti, Inventing Reality, the Politics of the Mass Media, New York, St. Martin's, 1986, an updated edition from 1993, especially chapters 3, scores of examples of direct advertiser pressure on media outlets. On the reactions to the slight, there were a related issue with a slight deviation on the New York Times that had rather significant consequences. And on that, this is covered in Behind the Profit Squeeze at the New York Times in Business Week, August 30, 1976, page 42. And this is what they had to say. Editorially and politically, the newspaper has also slid precipitously to the left and has become stridently anti-business in tone, ignoring the fact that the Times itself is a business and one with very serious problems. The article then remarks on the New York Times editorial supporting a hefty tax increase for business, commenting as follows, something like that, muses a Wall Street analyst, could put the Times out of business. An accompanying remark reminds that following a Times series on medical incompetence, a magazine run by the parent company lost $500,000 in pharmaceutical advertising. On the impact of these warnings, James Aronson goes over this, and the Times is a changing in these times, March 2nd to the 8th, 1977, page 24. Most important, he said, of all, were changes on the editorial side itself, designed, it would seem, to renew business confidence. In April 1976, publisher Salzberg had announced that Cousin B. Oakes, whose supervision of the editorial page had actually induced people to read a heretofore for largely unread page, would retire in January 1977 to spend the 2 years before his mandatory retirement traveling the world in search of fresh insight for the readership. Eyebrows rose over Oakes' 8-month notice and went even higher with the quick announcement of Oakes' replacement, Max Frankel. Sunday editor and former chief of the Washington Bureau, whom the Sunday staff had affectionately named Attila the Hun. Clearly, the lean to the left would halt. Will this make Business Week happy? First reports indicate that will. Advertising is up slightly, as is circulation. The battle for suburbs has been joined. For similar examples, there's castor oil or Camelot in The Economist on December 5th, 1987, page 101. This article notes that projects unsuitable for corporate sponsorship tend to die on the vine because stations have learned to be sympathetic to the most delicate sympathies of corporations, citing the case of public TV station WNET, which lost its corporate underwriting from Gulf Plus Western, as a result of a documentary called Hungry for Profit about multinationals buying up huge tracts of land in the third world. These stations had not been those of a friend, Gulf's chief executive wrote to the station, adding that the documentary was virtually anti-business, if not anti-American, even before the program was shown, in anticipation of negative corporate reaction. Station officials did all we could to get the program sanitized, including one station source. Most people believe that WNET would not make the same mistake today, The Economist concludes. Consider Felicity Barringer's Daily News tries flattery to woo back grocery ads. In the New York Times, June 14, 2001, B1. After the New York Daily News published a series of articles saying many city supermarkets were too dirty to meet state standards, all but one of the city's major supermarkets chains have refused to advertise in the newspaper, and some also stopped selling newspaper. Supermarket industry executives estimate the newspaper's weekly revenues loss at $50,000 to $100,000, leading to prompt overtures by the newspaper's business executives to repair relations with an important group of advertisers. And Tribano's sponsor notes in a modern potentate, Oxford University Press, 1978, on the influence of advertising upon the growth and direction of U.S. radio and television. Ben Bedekin's The Media Monopoly in Boston Beacon 5th edition, 1997, based on the original in 1983. Chapters 7 and 9 are particularly good. Martin Parenti's Inventing Reality, The Politics of the Mass Media, in New York, St. Martin's, 1986, updated edition from 1993, chapters 9. Pat's Orfendi's What Makes Public TV Public in the Progressive, January 1988, pages 35 to 38, discussing the failure of public television to raise public debate as a result of its reliance on corporate underwriting. James Aronson's Deadline for the Media, Today's Challenges to Press, TV, and Radio, New York, Bob's Merrill, 1972, pages 261 to 263, discussing a vicious local advertiser's boycott. Now, all of this is well understood. After all, what are the media? They are among the biggest corporations in just about any society. They don't care, literally, about what their readers have to say. They're, like all businesses, they have a product. The product is audiences. The market is advertising. So in other words, there's businesses selling audiences to other businesses. Now, it doesn't take genius just to figure out what kind of picture of the world would a media organization present relatively right-wing with some distance because it's owned and bought by big business, which isn't a secret. It's quite well known. Well, on a similar note, media in any society will also generally reflect the mild social democratic views of a population, but with a right-wing dissonance as well. A topic least studied but by the media, which will never will, but you have to dig like through declassified records, like declassified US cabinet records, is Western players concerned over communism as a form of economic independence, which is stated bluntly. For example, in an extensive 1955 study sponsored by the Woodrow Wilson Foundation and the National Planning Association conducted by a representative segment of the U.S. elite, including the chairman of the board of the General American Investors Company and the associate director of the Ford Foundation, the dean of the Columbia Business School, and the dean of Harvard's Graduate School of Public Administration. But there's public Yandel Alex, editorial in The Political Economy of American Foreign Policy, Its Concept, Strategy, and Limits, in New York, Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston, page 1955, page 42. And what they said is, the Soviet threat is total. I doubt any of us would read this in a newspaper or see it in a documentary. Military, political, economic, and ideological. Four of its specific aspects are important for an understanding of present and prospective international economic problems. It has meant, first, a serious reduction of the potential resource base and market opportunities of the West, owing to the subtraction of the communist areas from the international economy and their economic transformation in ways that reduce their willingness and ability to complement the industrial economies of the West. Second, a planned disruption of the free world economies by means of Soviet foreign economic policy and subversive communist movements. Third, a long-term challenge to the economic preeminence of the West arising from the much higher current rates of economic growth, particularly of heavy industry in the Soviet system. Four, a source of major insecurity in the international economy due to the fact that Soviet communism threatens not merely the political and economic institutions of the West, but the continued existence of human freedom and humane society everywhere. On Western planners' fears of Soviet developmental success, there's record number 55 in June 12, 1956, in the paper The Foreign Relations of the United States, 55 to 57, in Central and Southeastern Europe, published by the U.S. Government Printing Office in 1992, page 116. In June 1956, Secretary of State Foster Dulles told German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer that the economic danger from the Soviet Union was perhaps greater than the military danger. The USSR was transforming itself rapidly into a modern and efficient industrial state, while Western Europe was still stagnating. Similarly, after speaking to President Kennedy in 1961, British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan wrote in his diary that the Russians have a buoyant economy and will soon outmatch capitalist society in the race for material wealth. On this particular, there's Richard Reeves' President Kennedy Profile Power in New York, Simon and Schuster, in 1993, page 174, citing Arthur Horn's Harold Macmillan, Volume 2, 1957-86, published by Viking in 1989, came out in page 303 is what I referred. Likewise, a U.S. State Department report from the period, the USSR, like Dr. Johnson's Lady Preacher, has been able to do it all. We need always reflect that for the less developed countries of Asia, the USSR's economic achievement is a highly relevant one, that the USSR was able to industrialize rapidly, and as they see it from scratch is, despite any misgivings about the communist system, an encouraging fact to these nations. Consider Dennis Merrill's Bread and the Ballot, United States and India's Economic Development, 1947-63, Chapel Hills, published by the University of North Carolina. This came out in 1902, page 123. A 1961 memorandum from President Kennedy's special assistant, Arthur Schlesinger, explained with respect to Latin America, the hemisphere's level of expectation continues to rise, stimulated both by the increase in conspicuous consumption and by the spread of the Castro idea of taking matters into one's own hands. At the same time as living standards begin to decline, many people tend toward communism both as an outlet for social resentment, as a swift and sure technique for social modernization. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union hovers in the wings, flourishing large development loans and presenting itself as a model for achieving modernization in a single generation. This is from the report to the President of Latin American Mission, March 10, 1961, Foreign Relations of the United States, from 1961 to 1963, the American Republic's Washington, the U.S. Government Printing Office. There's a record of this of that also came out in 1996. The reference number is 7, page 13. On U.S. Cold War policies, a good analysis, more than John Lewis Garris would ever give you, is A Preponderance of Power by Madeleine Leffler. National Security, the Truman Administration, the Cold War, Stanford. Stanford University Press, 1992. Lynn Eden goes over this as well. In The End of the U.S. Cold War History, International Security, Volume 18, Number 1, Summer 993, page 174 to 207, discussing Leffler's study and the new consensus on the Cold War that it helped to establish among diplomatic historians. Gabriel Kolko's Confronting the Third World, United States Foreign Policy, 1945 to 80, published by the Pantheon in New York in 1988, with further citations to the internal government planning record on U.S. Cold War policies. Frankowski's Harry Truman and the War Scare of 1948, a successful campaign to deceive the nation, by St. Martin's in New York, 1993, Appendix A, showing that internal U.S. government estimates of Soviet military capabilities and intentions after World War II were highly dismissive of their capabilities, and were, I'm quoting, virtually unanimous in concluding that the Soviets currently had no wish to initiate hostilities with the West. In comparative East and West European economic development in the 20th century, another thing which isn't discussed much, nor do I think you'll hear or read it much in the press, is the World Bank. Yes, by the World Bank, not a radical outfit, given to hyperbole. The World Development Report, 1991, The Challenge of Development, published in New York by the Oxford University Press, good source, in 1991, page 14. The World Bank statistics indicate that Eastern Europe per capita gross domestic product, compared to that of the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is composed of most of the rich Western nations, declined from 64 to 54% between 1830 and 1913, then rose to 65% by 1950, declined to 63% by 73, then fell to 56% by 89. The overall growth rate from 1913 to 1950 was higher for Eastern Europe than for the OECD countries, you know, when they were in the Great Depression. 1.4% versus 1.1%, and higher from 1950 to 1989 for the OECD countries than for Eastern Europe, 2.3% versus 2%. The bank's statistics indicate that Eastern Europe's per capita gross domestic product was 15.7% higher than Latin America's in 1913, but 77.6% higher by 1989. Furthermore, none of these figures take into account wealth distribution, which was far more skewed both in the OECD countries in Latin America than in Eastern Europe. Consider the World Bank and Development, an NGO critique and World Bank response in Trochier Development Review in Dublin, Catholic Agency for World Development in 1990, page 9 to 27. This is an excerpt from page 21. The Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China have until recently been among the most prominent examples of relatively successful countries. that deliberately turned away from the global economy. But their vast size made inward-looking development more feasible than it would be for most countries. And even they eventually decided to shift policies and take a more active part in the global economy. The phrase relatively successful countries is stark. Relative, as some might know, means in comparison to others. So as opposed to saying the USSR and the PRC is failing, their economies are crumbling, well, that's not what were crumbling and so on. That's not what the stats show, not even according to the World Bank. They were relatively successful countries. And the growth rates of Eastern Europe and industrialization, a great deal more complementary analysis would be due. There is John Lewis's GADIS, which is a side issue but related, justification of his use of the containment concept. See, John Lewis GADIS and strategies of containment, a critical appraisal of post-war American national security policy, published in New York in the Oxford University Press, 1982. The exact words is this. The term containment poses certain problems, implying as it does a consistently defensive orientation in American policy. One can argue at length whether Washington's approach to the world since 1945 has been primarily defensive. I think it has, but the argument is irrelevant for the purposes of this book. What is important here is that American leaders consistently perceived themselves as responding to rather than initiating challenges to the existing international order. For this reason, it seems to be valid to treat with the idea of containment as a central theme of post-war national security policy. So we only know that there was a containment post-1945, like in any history book that you read, the main policy of the US was containment of the USSR, as we read. And according to Gaddis, it is merely because the US leaders perceived themselves as acting defensive, which is pretty critical. For Gaddis's reference, Gaddis finally gave definition of US foreign policy contrary to the major containment feature we're supposed to believe in. In Strategies of Containment, the same book, the exact words in pages 356 to 357 is this. What is surprising is the primacy that has been accorded economic considerations in shaping strategies of containment to the exclusion of other considerations. One would not expect to find in initiatives directed to self-consciously at the world at large, such decisive but parochial concerns. To a remarkable degree, containment has been the product not so much of what the Russians have done or what happened elsewhere in the world, but of internal forces operating within the United States. So there was no containment of the USSR, because the USSR, there weren't Russian troops in Angola, or Cuba, or Nicaragua. There was no containment of the USSR. They weren't Russian troops sitting across from West Germany, from East Germany to invade West Germany. There was no containment. There was only the US defense policy, as it's overwhelmingly described, was in response to internal forces in the US, like the alliance with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia's House of the Sword had nothing to do with the Russians, but their oil fields and so on. Nothing to do with what the Russians were doing. There was no containment. And to put it bluntly, there was no Cold War, because that's what the Cold War was, supposedly. The Russians move, the Americans move in position, pushing the Russians back or making them retreat. That's what the Cold War is meant to be, generally. Well, it's not. It didn't occur, at least if we were to take the number one scholar, John Lewis Gaddis, the number one dean of the field, saying straight out, there was no containment, and U.S. military policy had nothing to do with the Russians, but internal forces to the exclusion of other considerations. Also, the USSR internally, interestingly, this came across as, had more internal dissent, like on their media, than we could dream of having. I've never heard in the US press describe the US invasion or attack or occupation war nowadays of Iraq, whereas there's Danchev's broadcast in the USSR. See, for example, the Moscow radio, oops, calls Soviets invaders. New York Times in May 24, 1983, page A5. Serge Sherman's Moscow's facade on war and peace cracks a bit. May 29, New York Times, 1983, section 1, page 6, where famously in Russian talk show, radio talk show host denounced the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, something I doubt you'll read even in the New York Times. Mostly only not enough Iraqi insurgents have been killed or it's costing too much money. There is instead, henceforth, there's pragmatic squabbles. Is it working? Is it taking too long? Well, that's not expressing opposition. It's pragmatic squabbles. There were pragmatic squabbles in Hitler's general staff meetings after the loss at the Battle of Stalingrad. You know, there's not enough troop reinforcements. Mein Führer, I don't recommend we do anything to retake Stalingrad, famously sacked his general staff repeatedly, not because of opposition, which he ignored, not because of their opposition, as he acknowledged, but because of their pragmatic squabbles. There are instead, our time is running out, about 5 minutes, a listener's interesting analysis for warnings about the necessity for government intervention in the economy after the Second World War. Another issue you'll rarely see discussed, much as analyzed in the press, though not very much. See, for example, Paul A. Samuelson's Unemployment Ahead, a warning to the Washington expert in the New Republic, September 11, 1944, pages 297 to 299. In it, he says, every month, every day, every hour, the federal government is pumping millions and billions of dollars into the bloodstream of the American economy. It is as if we were building a TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, a massive New Deal public works project, every Tuesday. Did I say every Tuesday? Two TVAs every Tuesday would be near the truth. We have reached the present high levels of output and employment only by means of $100 billion of government expenditures, of which $50 billion represents deficits. In the usual sense, the word the present prosperity is artificial, although no criticism is thereby implied. Any simple statistical calculation will show that the automobile, aircraft, shipbuilding, and electronics industries combined, comprising the field with rosiest post-war prospects, can't possibly maintain the present level of employment, or one-half or one-third of it. It is demonstrable that the immediate demobilization period presents a grave challenge to our economy. Our current economic system is living on a rich diet of government spending. It will be found cheaper in the long run and infinitely preferable in human terms, to wean it gradually. For better or worse, the government under any party will have to undertake extensive action in the years ahead. Fortune magazine raised the issue in their headline article, Shall We Have Airplanes? In January 1948, page 77F. What they said is, the US aircraft industry is today producing at a rate that is less than 3% of its wartime peak. Its spokesmen speak frequently of free enterprise, but they speak just as frequently of long-range planning. It is crystal clear to them that they cannot live without one kind or another of government support. Yet subsidy is a shocking word to them. Its respected heads freely play the game of nagging and chiding the government, but it then transpires that their reproaches are made because the government has not gone far enough towards stating clearly and frankly its obligation to help new and improved air transports and efficient networks of air transportation, as well as fostering new programs for military planes. Every one of these proposals acknowledges the inability and unaided private capital to venture any deeper into technological terra incognita of the aircraft industry. Everyone acknowledges that that only the credit resources of the USA are sufficient to keep the aircraft industry going, to enable it to hire its engineers, buy its materials, pay wages to its labor force, compensate its executives, and pay dividends to its stockholders. The fact seems to remain, then, that the aircraft industry today cannot satisfactorily exist in a pure, competitive, unsubsidized, free enterprise economy. Never has it been able to. Its huge customer is always the United States government, whether in war or in peace. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, our time is slowly running out. But I'll continue a little bit on. We have about 3 minutes. In Aviation RFC, Reconstruction Finance Corporation, in Business Week, January 31, page 28, carries a similar picture of the U.S. economy and the aircraft industry at the time. The aircraft builders, even with tax carrybacks, are near disaster. Right now, the government is their only possible savior with orders, subsidies, or loans. There's also Frank Kofsky's Harry S. Truman and the War Scare of 1948, a successful campaign to deceive the nation. 993, page 2, arguing with substantial documentation that the Truman administration manipulated war scares for the purpose of sustaining and expanding U.S. industry through the military system under the Pentagon, citing business magazines and newspapers of the period that made it quite unmistakable that the aircraft industry would have collapsed had it not been for the big procurement orders that came in the wake of the war scare of 1948. The following years, the business press routinely recognized that continued high levels of military spending were essential to the U.S. economy. See, for example, Ward Gates in Approaching Recession in American Business in Magazine of Wall Street, May 31, 1952, page 252. Rearmament has played a large part in the increase in world trade directly after Korea and remains one of the basic elements in the future of world business. No better illustration could be had than the effects of the U.S. withdrawal from primary markets when it had about completed its stockpiling program. When this occurred, the primary markets practically fell apart. It's obvious that foreign economies, as well as our own, are now mainly dependent on the scope of continued arms spending in the country. Basic to continued high activity in industry is the government program of defense expenditures, actual and projected. Well, ladies and gentlemen, our time is up. I thank you for your listening, and I welcome your next visits on People's Question Time. Good night and goodbye. Take care.